This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Aesthetic Justice, a lecture and discussion with artist Carlos Mota and curator Niels van Tome. The event was organized within the framework of Provisions Learning Project's exhibition of the same title. It took place on June 14th, 2011.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. And thank you for coming to the Aesthetic Justice event with Carlos Mota. My name is Niels van Tome. I'm the curator of the Aesthetic Justice Project and the director of arts and media at Provisions Learning Project, which is an art and social change resource center and production center based in Washington, D.C. First of all, I would like to thank Sina and Cabinet for their enthusiasm and support in hosting this lecture and screening. Secondly, I would wish to acknowledge Lambent Foundation for providing a truly generous project grant for Aesthetic Justice. And without their support, the exhibition and its subsequent programming would not have been possible. Currently on view at Lambent Foundation in downtown Manhattan until June 22nd, the exhibition Aesthetic Justice presents the work of five artists, Alice Mdour, Raj Kamal Kalon, Carlos Mota and Josue Seda, and Larissa Sansour. Introducing the notion of aesthetic justice, the project interprets justice from an aesthetic perspective instead of a normative one. Underscoring the transformative potential of linking these concepts in the context of a group exhibition. The project investigates and makes visible how the specific aesthetic frameworks of the included artworks negotiate the subject matters they address. Aesthetic Justice grew from an initial investigation of the relationship between aesthetics and justice and connects to a broader deconstructive critique of human rights discourse. A month ago, the human rights scholar Thomas Keenan and I co-curated the Aesthetic Justice Seminar, which also included Carlos, which took place over the course of one day at the Hispanic Federation in New York. The seminar staged a series of conversations between the artists in the exhibition and human rights practitioners and activists. We are currently finishing a publication related to the overall projects, and we will be archiving all of the conversations from the seminar online. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Carlos Mota, lecturer and screening today, the last of a series of events related to aesthetic justice. Carlos's work was a chief inspiration for the exhibition and my thinking about justice in general. In his performance and video work, Six Acts, an Experiment in Narrative Justice and Resistance and Repression, the latter on view in the exhibition, he uses the term narrative justice, a notion of justice detached from the judicial field and focused on narrative and communication as pillars of reconciliation. Today, Carlos will present his lecture, Amnesia and Repression, a series of attempts to establish a memory project of political conflict from an aesthetic perspective, and we will screen a few of his videos, followed by a conversation between the two of us, and with participation of the audience, hopefully. Carlos Mota is a New York-based artist who was born in Bogota, Colombia. He works primarily in photography and video installation, using strategies from documentary and sociology to engage with specific political events in an attempt to observe their effects and suggest alternative ways to write and read these histories. Without further ado, I would like to give the word to Carlos. Please give him a warm applause. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Niels and Shannon from the Lambent and Sina for hosting today. It's a great opportunity to be able to talk here. The way I want to do this is going to be showing a video, and then I will read part of this presentation, then I will show another video, read a little more, and then hopefully... Oh, and then we will start a conversation with Niels that we hope you will all be part of. I think it's actually, it was a challenge for me to be included in this exhibition. As I had just finished working on this project that Niels just mentioned, and first started to work through the idea of narrative justice. So this lecture is actually something I wrote for a presentation in Buenos Aires about 8 months ago. It has been actualized for this presentation, given the fact that several things that I wrote about actually changed in the political situations that I'm going to reference, which is actually was actually an interesting development for the work. So what I'm going to do now is actually screen one of the videos from this project called Six Acts, an Experiment in Narrative Justice. And after we've seen the video, which is about 7 minutes long, I will start describing what the project is and the lecture itself. Yes, please.
Señor Presidente, Mariano Ospina Pérez. Bajo el peso de una honda emoción, me dirijo a Vuestra Excelencia, interpretando el querer y la voluntad de esta inmensa multitud que esconde su ardiente corazón, lacerado por tanta injusticia, bajo un silencio clamoroso, para pedir que haya paz y piedad para la patria. En todo el día de hoy, excelentísimo señor, la capital de Colombia ha presenciado un espectáculo que no tiene precedentes en su historia. Gentes que vinieron de todo el país, de todas las latitudes, de los llanos ardientes y de las frías altiplanicies, han llegado a congregarse en esta plaza, cuna de nuestras libertades, para expresar la irrevocable decisión de defender sus derechos. 2 horas hace que la inmensa multitud desemboca en esta plaza y no se ha escuchado, sin embargo, un solo grito. Porque en el fondo de los corazones solo se escucha el golpe de la emoción. Durante las grandes tempestades, la fuerza subterránea es mucho más poderosa. Y esta tiene el poder de imponer la paz cuando quienes están obligados a imponerla no la imponen. Señor Presidente, aquí no se oyen aplausos. Solo se ven banderas negras que se agitan. Señor Presidente, vos que sois un hombre de universidad, debéis comprender de lo que es capaz la disciplina de un partido que logra contrariar las leyes de la psicología colectiva para recatar la emoción en su silencio, como el de esta inmensa muchedumbre. Bien comprendéis que un partido que logra esto muy fácilmente podría reaccionar bajo el estímulo de la legítima defensa. Ninguna colectividad en el mundo ha dado muestras superiores a la presente. Pero si esta manifestación sucede, es porque hay algo grave, y no por triviales razones. Hay un partido de orden capaz de realizar este acto para evitar que la sangre siga derramándose y para que las leyes se cumplan, porque ellas son la expresión de la conciencia general. No me he engañado cuando he dicho que creo en la conciencia del pueblo, porque este concepto ha sido ratificado ampliamente en esta demostración, donde los vítores y los aplausos desaparecen, para que solo se escuche el rumor emocionado de los millares de banderas negras, que aquí se han traído para recordar a nuestros hombres, villanamente asesinados. Señor Presidente, serenamente, tranquilamente, con la emoción que atraviesa el espíritu de los ciudadanos que llenan esta plaza, os pedimos que ejerzáis vuestro mandato el mismo que os ha dado el pueblo para devolver al país la tranquilidad pública. Todo depende ahora de vos. Quienes anegan en sangre el territorio de la patria cesarían en su ciega perfidia. Esos espíritus de mala intención callarían al simple imperio de vuestra voluntad. Amamos hondamente a esta nación y no queremos que nuestra barca victoriosa tenga que navegar sobre ríos de sangre hacia el puerto de su destino inexorable. Señor presidente, en esta ocasión no reclamamos tesis económicas o políticas. Apenas os pedimos que nuestra patria no transite por caminos que nos avergüencen ante propios y extraños. Os pedimos hechos de paz y de civilización. Nosotros, señor presidente, no somos cobardes. Somos descendientes de los bravos que aniquilaron las tiranías en este suelo sagrado. Somos capaces de sacrificar nuestras vidas para salvar la paz y la libertad de Colombia. Impedid, Señor, la violencia. Queremos la defensa de la vida humana, que es lo que puede pedir un pueblo. En vez de esta fuerza ciega desatada, debemos aprovechar la capacidad de trabajo del pueblo para beneficio del progreso de Colombia. Señor presidente, nuestra bandera está enlutada. Y esta silenciosa muchedumbre y este grito mudo de nuestros corazones solo os reclama que nos tratéis a nosotros, a nuestras madres, a nuestras esposas, a nuestros hijos y a nuestros bienes, como queráis que os traten a vos, a vuestra madre, a vuestra esposa, a vuestros hijos y a vuestros bienes. Os decimos finalmente, excelentísimo Señor, bienaventurados los que entienden que las palabras de concordia y de paz no deben servir para ocultar sentimientos de rencor y exterminio. Malaventurados los que en el gobierno ocultan, tras la bondad de las palabras, la impiedad para los hombres de su pueblo, porque ellos serán señalados con el dedo de la ignominia en las páginas de la historia.
Those of you that just came in, would you like to sit down? There are some chairs here before we move on. Okay. Through artistic projects, I seek to reflect on political and historical events with the intention of understanding the effect that these have on the formation of subjectivity and on the way in which we live our lives. I have had a particular interest in suggesting alternative perspectives of history, highlighting instances in which the oppressive power constructs or destroys processes of individual or collective memories of conflict and violence. I will discuss two recent video projects which attempt to offer a space for the articulation of memory from an aesthetic perspective. I shall base my reflection on the concept of narrative justice, a notion of justice detached from the judicial field and focused on narrative and communication as pillars of a possible reconciliation. I borrow this term from Columbia University psychology professor Jack Saul, who has developed performative workshops with victims of trauma, using narration as a means of conflict resolution. I am interested in this idea because it enables me to use fictional strategies, documentary video, and performance to try to construct spaces for social and political interaction based on the memory of violence and traumatic events. Before showing you or discussing some of these works, which actually I have already done, one of which reflects on a specific scenario of Colombia's political history, I wish to begin with a reflection on what I consider the lack of culture of memory within the context of Colombia's political history, a context to which I am close and which has been a source of inspiration for the development of my work. It is not my intention to put forward personal ideological stances, but rather to seek resources to discuss conflicting histories. As I originally sat down to write this lecture back in June 2010, Colombia had just proclaimed Juan Manuel Santos winner of the presidential election. The official candidate of the U party won with almost 70% of the votes. This result came as no surprise to anyone, but at the same time, it was a great disappointment for me. Santos' election seemed to me, at the time, to reiterate what I consider an obstruction to a possible memory project involving the armed conflict, which has lashed Colombia for the last 60 years. I thought, given Santos' critical role as Minister of Defense during Álvaro Uribe's war-driven government, that his mandate would continue to ignore the needs of the countless victims of Colombia's civil war. Today, my disappointment has turned into expectation, because Santos has successfully pushed for a law approved by the House of Representatives and the Senate, La Ley de las Víctimas, the Victims Law, which is a policy of an administrative reparation for victims of forced displacement and other forms of violence. This governmental initiative, rooted in the judicial system, represents a huge advancement in fostering a culture of memory in a country where human rights are constantly violated. The Colombian conflict is far too complex to be described in just a few words, but it may be stated that it is an ideological, economic, and class conflict. It is also a conflict fueled by the production and traffic of illegal substances, and involving guerrillas, paramilitary groups, and the state's armed forces. It is a conflict of clashing political powers, and it is, above all, a persistent, degraded, and ongoing conflict. These three characteristics have prevented both a systematized process of memory of its victims in the social and cultural sphere, and the process of doing justice at the institutional level through the assignment of responsibility to the multiple perpetrators of violence. How can one think of remembering or commemorating a conflict which does not come to an end? Conflict situations in countries like Guatemala, South Africa, and Argentina, for instance, have demonstrated the way in which the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, civilian and military trials, and the fostering of a culture of memory from the fields of culture and education have made it possible for memory to be constructed and history written on the basis of revisionist perspectives. In Colombia's recent history, in addition to the humanitarian tragedy represented by a population of four million people displaced from their lands by the armed actors, there have been a series of specific cases of violations of human rights, of lack of respect for human life, and of political manipulation, which I have found to be particularly revealing. In spite of their having been publicly denounced and their being known to the civilian population, these cases have not been officially tried, nor have their responsibilities been clearly admitted, and consequently, they are open wounds that resist healing. As an example, I would like to mention two events which at two different moments in history have involved the armed forces of the Colombian state in the violation of human rights. On mentioning these examples, I am not seeking to take sides or convey a polarized perspective of the conflict, since the Colombia's guerrillas, for example, and other actors in the conflict commit acts that are equally barbaric. I do so with the intention of emphasizing the imminent fragility and the lack of respect for life in Colombia in the context of a conversation about memory. Firstly, the most recent case is that of the so-called falsos positivos, or false positives. As a result of the incentives offered by the national government to the military that produce positive results in the fight against the armed actors, especially against the FARC guerrillas, members of the Colombian army established a macabre practice which consisted in the assassination of innocent civilians pretending that they were guerrillas killed in combat. These extrajudicial executions caused a political scandal in 2008, and they have begun to be penalized, but their mere existence demands a diligent questioning of the policies of a government during whose administration it was possible to carry out such actions. Secondly, the systematic extermination of members of the Patriotic Union, La Unión Patriótica, a left-wing political party founded in 1985 as part of a legal political proposal representing several actors, among them the FARC guerrillas and the Colombian Communist Party. The party became consolidated independently from the armed struggle. However, two presidential candidates that are part of this project, 8 congressmen, 13 deputies, 17 aldermen, 11 mayors, and thousands of militants were assassinated by paramilitary groups, members of the Colombian state, security forces, and drug traffickers. Hundreds of its members were displaced inside and outside the country. The majority of the cases have never reached a court of justice. Rather, they propagate a silence regime and the fear of freedom of political expression. These two situations have left thousands of victims seeking legal and social justice. The exiled, the displaced, and their families have organized themselves in different ways to remember, denounce, and act. But at not finding support from governmental institutions, they remain as minorities whose grief has not been acknowledged as it deserves to be. A project of memory of the armed conflict is a social and cultural project, but it is also a justice project. Personally speaking, I consider that Colombia is a country that tends to seek refuge in amnesia, perhaps due to a survival or self-protection drive. In spite of the state's recent initiatives to render the victims visible, in Colombia it is common to forget the past. No matter how many times these images may be repeated before our eyes, to forget those who have been assassinated or forced to disappear is habitual. That is why Colombia has historically tended to be an unfair country that has been indebted to its victims. In the field of art, attention to the victims has been central to the moving sculptures by artists such as Doris Salcedo, the paintings of Beatriz González, and the works of video artists such as Juan Manuel Echavarria, Oscar Muñoz, Wilson Diaz, or from a younger generation, Edwin Sanchez. My intention is to adhere to these efforts and to consider the important role of memory as a strategy for social, cultural, and perhaps political reconciliation through an art practice. With the aim of illustrating this idea, I will present to you two recent projects through which I have attempted to forge a concept and a project involving a memory of conflict that is detached from the judicial sphere and aligned with an aesthetic practice. In this case, the term aesthetic implies an ambit that is extra-official, artistic and ephemeral, of a historical character and based on narrative, representation, fiction, and communication among citizens, a narrative justice. 6 Acts, an Experiment in Narrative Justice, is a series of 6 performance acts which took place in March 2010 in several public squares in Bogota during the campaign for the presidential elections. 6 actors read historical political speeches originally delivered by presidential candidates who were assassinated because of their political ideas. Rafael Uribe Uribe, assassinated in 1914. Jorge Eliezer Gaitán, assassinated in 1948. Jaime Pardo Leal, assassinated in 1987. Luis Carlos Galán, assassinated in 1989. Carlos Pizarro, assassinated in 1990. And Bernardo Jaramillo Osa, assassinated in 1990. All the speeches emphatically stress the need to envisage peace as the primordial element for the rectification of social inequality in Colombia. The actors represent a variety of Colombian identities. They are citizens with different social and ethnic origins. These actions constituted interventions in the framework of everyday life. aimed at repeating, emphasizing, and recalling the same words of denouncement that cost these political leaders their lives. And they sought, through performance and fiction, to go back to important historical moments of the conflict with the wish of generating encounters amongst the passerby or the audience, which might have made it possible to reconsider the value of those ideas that were chastised. Through this work, I was interested in approaching history from the perspective of documentary fiction. In this case, fiction enabled me to forge a space of memory mediated by an artistic strategy. A couple of months after performing this action, Bernardo Jaramillo Osa and Carlos Pizarro León Gómez' original campaign posters, dated from 1990, began to appear in the streets of Bogotá during the presidential campaign. The two candidates were assassinated during 1990, and both represented left-wing ideologies. Jaramillo was the official candidate of the Patriotic Union, and Pizarro, for his part, had been the leader of the 19th of April Revolutionary Movement, a guerrilla group that laid down their weapons and became consolidated as a political party. I do not know who the author, I don't know if that was clear. So what happened is there was this public intervention that replicas of the original posters of the of their campaigns were pasted all around town. So there was a kind of synchronicity between the project that I had set out to do in public sphere with this action, whose author I actually don't know, ignore. I don't know who that was. I don't know who the authors of these interventions were, but I sympathize with these actions, since few are the voices of resistance and opposition featuring a discourse of respect for life and inclusion that have had a place in Colombian political culture. The posters alluding to the assassinated candidates fulfill their function of highlighting the absence of a discourse of opposition and of social rectification based on the field of representation.
Quiero contar una experiencia muy particular de lo que es la represión. Mi nombre es Josué Uceda, soy estudiante de medicina de la Universidad Pública de Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Mi trabajo práctico se realiza en el Hospital Escuela, un hospital público que cubre la mayoría de las especialidades médicas. Estoy diariamente en contacto con personas pobres, con personas indígenas y con personas de poca educación. Un día de agosto de mucho afán, al salir del hospital, tomé un atajo en el carro para llegar a casa rápidamente. Era justo las 12 del mediodía y repentinamente quedé atascado en el tráfico. Justo enfrente de los carros ocurría una protesta, una marcha en contra del golpe de Estado. Era una marcha de la resistencia, esa perseverante e incansable resistencia que diariamente se organizaba para expresar su frustración y su ira en relación al brutal golpe de Estado. Esa resistencia tan temida por los tantos en Honduras que se han sentado en el poder. Pude asegurar que era una marcha pequeña, de aproximadamente 200 personas, y era conducida por un grupo o asociación en particular. No supe nunca el nombre, no quedó tiempo de ver o de preguntar. Inesperadamente vi personas que empezaron a correr, a gritar en pánico al otro extremo de la calle, donde comenzaba la marcha. Los policías estaban golpeando a los manifestantes, les lanzaban bombas lacrimógenas y las personas se tiraban al suelo intoxicadas, llorando. Algunos se auxiliaban, dándose y repartiéndose agua y pañuelos entre sí. Los carros empezaron a pitar. Yo sentía ya el caos. Como pude, crucé el semáforo. No tenía otra alternativa que ir a la calle donde sucedía todo. Vi cómo los policías le pegaban a los participantes de la marcha, que hasta entonces parecía haber sido pacífica. En este punto comencé también yo a sentir los gases dentro del carro. Necesitaba aire, así que abrí las ventanas. Me estaba asfixiando, me picaba la cara y tenía lágrimas en mis ojos. Mientras los veía golpear a las personas, odiaba a esos policías con sus identidades escondidas tras los cascos y uniformes. Los odiaba profundamente y le gritaba, hijos de puta. Milagrosamente logré avanzar unos metros cuando algunos manifestantes me pidieron auxilio y golpeaban a mi carro para que los recogiera. Tenía traumas en la cabeza y en el tórax a causa de los garrotazos. Yo los vi. Fueron ellos, fueron los policías los que les hicieron esto. Sin dudarlo, monté a esas dos personas al auto, un hombre y una mujer que sangraban. Logramos salir de la pequeña guerra que sucedía a unos 500 metros del hospital escuela y logré tomar una ruta alterna para llevarlos a emergencias del mismo hospital. Les supliqué que les dijeran que no venían de la marcha de protesta. Les dije que era mejor decir que los habían asaltado o golpeado, pero no decir que pertenecían a la resistencia. Si lo decían, era seguro que no los iban a atender. Si decían así, los tomarían como delincuentes, revoltosos, o chincheros de izquierda, comunistas, y demorarían su atención médica. Recordar esto me da coraje. Lloro otra vez y me lleno de angustia e impotencia al pensar que el golpe triunfó, que la Constitución se violó supuestamente en nombre de la democracia, pero esto no ha logrado cambiar aún el curso de los hechos para la resistencia, que todavía lucha. De hecho, se ha consolidado y ha tomado fuerza. Ahora la resistencia se esposa como una esperanza futura para la rectificación política y el orden social de Honduras. Ser pobre en un país pobre es miserable doblemente. Ser rico en un país pobre es doblemente miserable y mezquino.
The second project I would like to mention is the video Resistance and Repression, a collaboration with Josue Uceda, a medical student in Tegucigalpa who witnessed several acts of repression against demonstrators in a march of resistance of the resistance movement against the coup d'etat in Honduras. Josue has an articulated political discourse and he wished to share his experience and ideas with me with the purpose of narrating the brutal abuse of citizens by the police authorities. Together, we wrote a narrative based on his personal experience. The video features Josue telling me via Skype from his phone, from his home in Tegucigalpa, the story of the beatings he witnessed and of the desire for survival of a resistance movement. From an aesthetic and conceptual point of view, we wanted to make reference to the decentralized journalism of blogs, which have made it possible to have access to extra-official versions of events of this kind. This video is also a reflection on media representation and in particularly on photography as a representation within a political conflict. The video contrasts Josue's testimony with a photograph taken by him of a victim of police brutality. These two modes of representation are intentionally exposed. Who is shooting? Who is being shot? Who is looking? What are the multidirectional relationships at stake within that triangular relationship? The ethical and aesthetic challenges posed by these questions demand the breaking down of subject positions and reveal the hierarchical way that we have traditionally learned to think of representation, that of an image of something which is made for someone's and critical consumption. Shifting and turning around this one-way relation to highlight the responsibility of the viewer to the subject and the maker, of the maker to the subject, and the subject to the viewer, can lead one to productively consider the political challenges of representation. When we stop favoring the viewer and implicate him or her, we confront social clashes, which are often irreconcilable, yet offer opportunities to think through antagonism and difference ethically, aesthetically, and politically. And that is what this diagram is supposed to represent. Similarly to Six Acts, Resistance and Repression also intends to present an alternative narrative that considers the importance of human life, the role of citizenship, and the plural understanding of the concept of democracy. In a similar way to Colombia, Honduras seeks to the resolution of a polarizing conflict. Likewise, it is the people of Honduras' endeavor to give testimony, disseminate, and narrate with the intention of changing history in order to be able to reconcile themselves with the forces of oppression. To conclude, I would like to echo the last words of the introduction of Colombian historian Gonzalo Sánchez's book, Guerra, Memorias e Historia, Wars, Memory and History, which read, "In order to give a meaning to my work as a whole, I have chosen the dual memory, individual and collective, and history, actual evolution of a process, or if you will, subjectivity and discursive rationality. What follows is an attempt to reconstruct their multiple connections, interweaving my closest personal experiences of contemporary war and those which are beyond my personal memory, in the civil wars inscribed as social periods in the history of Colombia and the political cultural context that it has fallen to my lot to live." Thank you so much. So before we move to this, having a conversation with Niels and all of you, I would like to play an epilogue to one of the acts of six acts, which followed the performance by Atala Bernal, the name of the actress, in a place called Soacha in a southern suburb of Colombia. And she's performing a speech by presidential candidate Luis Carlos Galán. And this happened after she finished performing, which I think is a good place perhaps to begin a conversation about some of these issues.
Mucho gusto.
Isabel Mesa.
Mucho gusto. ¿Cómo le va?
He estado atento a su discurso.
Sí, señor.
Muy, muy bueno.
Muchas gracias. Felicito. Muchas gracias, señor.
Y eso necesitamos una campaña. Pero no le he oído hablar de el adulto mayor, el abuelito. Uh-huh. Y tenemos un problema ahí con el asunto de los bonos.
¿Cuál es el problema?
El problema es que no nos pagan cumplir, vean la fecha que es. Y nos están diciendo que hasta la semana entrante. Yeah. Y así nos llevan.
¿Y por qué?
Que no hay plata.
Buenos días.
Venimos toda la ancianita a saludarlo.
Mucho gusto, ¿cómo está? Mucho gusto, ¿cómo está? Buenos días, ¿cómo está? Mucho gusto. Atala, ¿cómo está? Mucho gusto, ¿cómo está?
Bueno, nosotros venimos a ver cómo es la colaboración.
Buenos días, ¿cómo está?
Sí, porque a los abuelitos, buenos días.
Buenos días, ¿cómo está?
Nos están dejando a un lado y no es justo, no es justo. Llevamos ya desde diciembre, no hay un apoyo en los talleres que nos están haciendo, nos llevan, es una alabaza para darnos, eso no es justo. Yo lo declaro con mi boca. Ante Dios, están mirando las injusticias que está cometiendo con estos abuelos, que no solamente uno ni dos.
¿La alcaldía?
Cantidad.
La alcaldía.
Cantidad. El alcalde no está preocupando por sus hijos, por su pueblo. Está dejando a sus abuelos tirados.
En la calle.
Tirados. Nosotros merecemos respeto.
Sí, señora, tiene toda la razón.
¿O no?
Sí, señora.
Permiso, señora, le explico lo que está sucediendo aquí, cómo está. Nosotros desafortunadamente no tenemos capacidad de legislación o de influenciar la situación que está sucediendo. Estamos haciendo un texto histórico del candidato presidencial asesinado Luis Carlos Galán, que fue acá, tratando de recuperar un poco sus ideas.
Sí, señora.
Y de hacernos pensar esas ideas.
Porque le cortan la vida a las personas que realmente
que sí pueden,
claro, servir
las ideas
mejor.
Si estamos en esta historia de José Antonio Galán,
de Luis Carlos Galán,
que fue un mártir aquí en la plaza de Soacha. Entonces, ¿por qué nosotros también no nos unimos y vamos a la batalla que él decía muy clarito, que el pueblo unido nunca será vencido? Y por eso fue que él fue muerto. Entonces, ¿por qué no nos unimos con ustedes también y nosotros gritamos esa misma palabra aquí entre todos? El pueblo unido
Nunca será vencido.
Entonces vamos por ellos. Si ellos no pueden ayudarnos, vamos a esperar a la persona que dice que nos va a ayudar, porque aquí hay mucho pelagato en esta alcaldía que no hacen sino mirar a toda esta, y es lo mejor.
Lo sentimos mucho.
Mirarlos y salen así, mire, y se van.
Mírenlo. Sí, señor.
Con eso yo termino mi...
Muchas gracias a ustedes.
Lamento que no podemos tener una acción más concreta, pero podemos de repente compartir este material con las autoridades.
Con las autoridades, sí.
Señor alcalde, que es el que tiene que estar sobre esto y ir. ¿Por qué él ha ido? Él ha ido dos veces a León 13, donde yo estoy afiliada. ¿Y qué nos ha prometido?
Thank you, Carlos, for your excellent talk. So I had prepared some questions, and this was one of the questions that came up, and Carlos said, let's start with that, because it brings up an interesting conflict that we see within the work itself. Throughout your talk, you mentioned your interest in approaching history from the perspective of what you call documentary fiction. And in this conflict that we just saw, the fictionalized aspect of your performance, or the performance that you stage in public space, actually clashes with the political reality of the bystanders. And to me, the scene that we just saw highlights some of the limits of socially and politically engaged artistic practices. And I'm wondering why you decided to interfere, but also why did you decide to expose your interference as a part of the project?
Well, I think it's actually this. It was a little bit of a challenge for me to choose to include this in the work, in the sense that it made the piece so vulnerable, and also it kind of showed, as you said, perhaps the limit of my engagement, in the sense that I set out to create this public interventions within these public squares. Without really knowing what the outcome would be, and then when this happened, this rupture between the fiction that we had created and the kind of intentionality of the piece completely clashed with the reality of that situation, which is an outcome that we were expecting, but we weren't quite sure how it would play out within the script that we had. So to me, it's actually bringing it in. It was a way of bringing exactly attention to that vulnerability of that practice, and to point to the fact that this iteration of that friction and within that space delineates, I think, the relationship between aesthetic and politics in a really interesting manner. I actually think that the gesture of creating this intervention in public space was a form of an effective form of social intervention, and I was extremely surprised when I found myself literally shitting in my pants in front of these people, apologizing for my lack of being able to help, right? For the inability of this aesthetic gesture to actually be considered a form of reparation, which is what I was talking about throughout the whole time, and what the work was about. So when I found myself in that space of actually facing the crowd, facing the people, and facing the anxiety of the actress, because she gave me this really striking look at some point, saying, "You know, come and save me right now. Like, what do I do now?" So it actually, I think that bringing that into the conversation became the kind of anchor of the project, in a sense, mm-hmm. and in which this documentary fiction reality is exposed in ways that we could not control mm-hmm. in any ways.
It brings me to another question, which both relates to Six Acts and resistance and repression, as well as most of your work. It is collaborative in nature. And I was wondering how you see the role of collaboration within your work, and how do you position yourself as an artist towards people in challenging political and social situations?
Yeah, well, I think that's an interesting question in the sense that I actually don't think that the work is collaborative in nature. I think I work with people, but there is certainly an authorial voice that in these projects that we've seen, the work is scripted and developed with people that are playing a part. I don't know how much you can think of that as a collaborative exercise. I think I work together with people, but I'm not necessarily shaping the kind of conceptual basis of the work in a collaborative way. Not to say that there is any merit to, but I just think that it's important to demarcate the limits of both of those spaces. There are other works that I have developed that are collaborative in a fuller way. But certainly in the case of these pieces that we've seen today, the work with the actors became the motor for them being successful at all. Because it was actually not about interpreting a role of the politician reading the speech, but actually re-articulating and reenacting these words within a very specific timely period of the presidential, in the case of Six Acts, of the presidential campaign in 2010, and the very specific political demands that the left wanted to see reflected in public opinion and that were not articulating. So that's what these people were doing. I don't see them really performing the role of the politician, but actually performing themselves, a kind of echoing these words and these ideas. Hence, the choice of actors and actresses bringing a gender variant there that was not present. Three of the actresses are performing texts by male politicians, but it was important for me to bring, you know, to kind of universalize, in a sense, the scope of these ideas. In the case of the other video with Josue, the video was mostly his idea at first, because he really wanted to come across, to narrate the things that he was seeing and that he could share with people around him, but they wouldn't. He wanted them to come out of Tegucigalpa at that given time. So we, was a much more collaborative process altogether.
Mm-hmm. I resistance and repression is part of the aesthetic justice exhibition, and so I lived in the past couple of months with this video. I watched it many times over and over again, and I have a question related to the structure of the video. Part one, which is called The Word, seemingly gives a narrative account of a witnessing of a police brutality by Josue, whereas the second part, which is called The Image, provides a seemingly objective visual representation of the same event. However, part one is staged as a Skype conference, obviously, which is an equally oral and visual medium. And additionally, you have also played with cinematic processes such as editing and acting, which means that you aren't just documenting a real event or somebody who narrates an event. I was wondering why, despite the formal richness of the first part, you have called it The Word.
Mm. Well, as I said during the presentation, I think this video is really about that last image, and about the relationship between a form of narration and a form of visual representation. So it was, of course, important to conceive of the first part and that narrative aspect of that piece also in those cinematic terms, hence the close-ups and the proximities and the kind of seeming informality of the Skype conversation, which was actually quite deliberate from both of our parts. Josue spent a long time fixing the light in the back so that it would appear as if it wasn't lit at all. But to me, it's actually about the striking nature of that photographic image, the kind of after image, and the possibility of registering what that image is depicting, which is ultimately what he is narrating. But the way that we are seeing that image from the perspective of a viewer, of a kind of, as I said, they're an uncritical or disengaged consumer of the image. It was an opportunity for me to reflect upon this triangular relationship that I wanted to expose and that I think I did in the text. So I wanted to kind of create a dichotomy between the narration and the caption and the visuality of the photographic image in itself.
So the editing was more like a strategy to make that dichotomy visible.
Exactly.
Yeah. I had prepared a very difficult question about human rights, but I will keep that aside. Because Carlos has kindly asked me to.
Well, I actually asked you to post it to the audience to see if we can we can work on it together.
Well, the
and maybe that's a good way of opening up.
Exactly. So I will ask this question to the audience, and hopefully I will get some response. But both the idea of aesthetic and narrative justice, aesthetic justice, the idea behind the exhibition, narrative justice, the basic principle upon which these two works are built, seek alternative ways to imagine futures for the notion and practice of justice by moving away from a strictly legal interpretation of its subject matter. Now, when I'd gotten the text of Carlos's lecture beforehand, and while I was reading it, it became apparent that the term human rights violations was mentioned a few times throughout the text. And I was wondering whether, you know, since we both don't align ourselves with normative ideas of justice, whether we are also seeking a new understanding of human rights detached from a strictly legal application. And it's very difficult territory, of course. And in a sense, I was trying to ask Carlos whether there is a specific way that artistic practices can open up a new imaginative space for human rights beyond the narrow confines of the nation state and legal systems through aesthetic and artistic practices. And then Carlos told me, but this is, I can't answer this. But maybe somebody in the audience might want to reflect on this. Or not.
Andrea, yes, Andrea, of course.
I just love Rita's work and what we're an experience that I used to be at the conference at the NMAI Museum downtown Manhattan. It was a conference on contemporary Native American art, and it was very clear in that dialogue that was happening there that they very much, that community very much leaves the contemporary art as a site in which re-recognition of, you know, identity and ethics and recognition of self is possible, but that's very much, I think, from within that community. You know, doing their own work, doing contemporary art, very much contemporary art, conceptual art, as we know, that's completely negated in all certain cycles of artistic practice, but it's nevertheless very present. Looks for it, and I think it was very interesting for me to think, to hear that belief that art is the place where you can reconstitute a culture that was, you know, there was an attempt to destroy it, and then there's no recognition in this country of that attempt to destroy it in a large way. There's no collective consciousness about that. So I don't know. I just thought as an anecdote to offer that to your question. Mm.
Well, what I was telling Niels as we were having dinner before coming here is that I think the notion of justice is one that is, it's a little bit different from the notion of human rights in the sense that human rights are so much rooted in a kind of humanist liberal perspective of granting the respect and the value of life, where I think justice is a much more defined normative space that does not allow, it's harder to reconfigure. So I don't know exactly what it would mean for to redefine from a traditionally liberal cultural space like art or an artistic practice, that liberal idea of the rights of humans and their violation. So one example that comes to mind, of course, it's the work of organizations such as Witness and people that are working mediatically and producing video works engaged in denouncing through aesthetic means. Yet their desired outcome is a legislative one and one of a judicial reparation. So that's the part that I think it's really intertwined and hard to separate, is that locked relationship between justice and human rights, because it seems like the outcome of one is completely inseparable from the other one. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense. So I think that's the place that it would be interesting to see if they can be actually separated or ruptured, even in a violent way, to think of different ways of approaching both of those notions. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Andrea, maybe that's the space of art, as you're suggesting this community considered it, but...
I mean, I thought it was very... I was very moved by that.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought it was an interesting place of, overlapping this idea of political work and cultural work, but without literally, like, what's the woman saying? I'm blanking her name. Does this juridical art that works in Chicago, closing the supermax prisons and changing like the people who run the prison system in Chicago. What's her name?
Okay. I know who you mean.
Thank
you. Hello?
That's her, Laura Jo Reynolds.
Yes.
That's like one thing of like translating, like making art a political action. But I thought what was interesting about her position of our Native American colleagues is this. It's another idea of that art becomes this kind of dignity, kind of reconstituting dignity, that was destroyed through human rights violations.
Right.
And that was, as culture, the side of bringing that. I think that was really an interesting question. I mean, the whole conference was called Essentially Indigenous, and they were discussing the question of indigeneity, the essentialism within indigenous discourses, which I think is a really interesting question.
But I think in response to that, Andrea, and what you're talking, Niels, I think what you're suggesting is that the category of human rights is a narrow category that in itself may replicate that same violation that it is seeking to denounce.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, yeah. I mean, and also the way that we can only think about human rights as a violation,
exactly,
and not as a basic freedom or something like that. Mm. So I'm wondering whether the role of arts is to, or could be, a way to enhance like an idea of human rights that is based upon that, I wouldn't call it the universal principle, but upon a basic freedom again, instead of something that we have to adhere to because some powerful constituencies make us do so. Mm.
Were you going to say something before? Yes.
Because
I saw you go.
Okay, I was just thinking. I mean, it's all very thought-provoking. It makes me think of the conflicts between memory and justice. But I would be curious to hear how you define aesthetics and what you are talking about when you say justice. Because if you think of it as extrajudicial, what does that mean exactly? I mean, justice for whom? I just organized with Lawrence Wessler something called an all-day symposium. Weeks ago, I think it was on May 7th, called Second Thoughts on the Memory Industry. And some of the panels address these kinds of questions. It was Art Spiegelman, Francine Prose, looking at these aesthetic responses narrate various. I mean, it was all investigating different kinds of responses, legal, aesthetic, and otherwise, literary, to political violence. It wasn't looking at the political violence itself, it was looking at the various kinds of responses. And there was also a panel on Truth and Reconciliation Commissions and tribunals and things like that, with Ian Baruma and another gentleman, Juan Mendez, I think. He's a UN rapporteur on torture, and along with Witness, it made me think that you might want to engage. It sounds like you already have reached out to them, but it sounds like you might both want to engage with those legal, these NGOs that deal with these kind of questions, like the International, the ICJ, the International Center for Transitional Justice.
Right.
And I also know there's somebody at Brown, who's the head of the theater program, doing incredible work, also looking at genocide in Rwanda and using theater as a space to, as a space for, I would call it, thanks to you, narrative justice. You know, I didn't really contemplate that term previously. I've just known people who have written about narrative justice as it applies, you know, legal academics looking at, let's say, transcripts of the Nuremberg trials or other kinds of storytelling. You know, sorry for the ramble, but basically I just it made me jump into other spaces that you might connect with.
Yes, I mean, I think the we had the privilege, and I really call this a privilege, to organize a seminar at the Hispanic Federation about a month ago, where we, for example, staged a dialogue between Carlos and Sam Gregory of Witness to talk about not only about the work, but basically about each other's work. And I mean, it was very interesting for me and also very educational for me as a curator to link these artistic practices, which always seem so detached from reality, you know, or from the real issues you're talking about, and to connect them to people in the field who are working with them on a day-to-day basis. And I think the really refreshing part of the seminar was the fact that, the dichotomy between artistic practices and activist practices was completely left undiscussed, which I thought was really interesting and really great, because otherwise there wouldn't be, you know, a way to talk to each other, and I think that was really interesting. But basically, the idea of aesthetic justice, or the term aesthetic justice, of course, is a provocation. But when I coined the term, I actually found out a little bit later that it already existed. In particular, there is this American philosopher called Roman Beardsley, who coined the term in 1973 in an article that he wrote for the Journal for Aesthetics and Education. But he basically talked about aesthetic justice in relationship to aesthetic welfare, and was thinking about aesthetically pleasing environments as a way to enhance an idea of justice. And of course, I'm not really interested in the idea of beauty, or I'm interested in the idea of beauty, but I'm also interested in how how we can move away or how we can understand aesthetics not strictly defined to its, you know, connotation of beauty. So that was one move, deconstructive move, let's say. And then the other one was justice. Do not look at justice as, or not think about it as the idea of, or the belief in equality, but actually in its opposite, in the belief of the difference and the acceptance of difference. And for this idea, the writings of Judith Butler were very inspirational, and especially her books Precarious Life and Frames of War, in which she has started to think about justice based upon the acceptance of violence and nonviolence as a precarious relationship between between people. So in a way, the idea of justice is more based upon a global idea, or an idea of global justice, as the idea of legal or judicial justice. And I think in coining those two terms, I was really interested in the conflicts that would arise, and the questions that would be brought up. And I don't really have a clearly answer to all these questions, but I hope they will stimulate people to think differently about both the fields of justice and both the fields of aesthetics.
To me, actually, the interest in justice departs from my interest in injustice, and thinking of what would make an unjust situation just, you fall upon this brick wall, which is the kind of normative idea of the judicial sphere. Laws as something that repairs in a very tangible way the losses of the victim. So I think both of these projects, and in particular the Six Acts, are about the idea of the victim. and the lack of reparation or of reparative justice in considering the life of a victim that is never acknowledged, that is it's stripped of its citizenship, that it's stripped of its voice and of its functionality within society. So along those lines, to me, that seeking to find a way of providing, if I'll be, you know, if only symbolically, a space for an understanding of a reparation of the unjust into a just situation that is stripped out of a system that is completely oppressive, because the judicial system is corrupt, bureaucratic, and oppressive by nature. Well, I don't know if by nature, but that's the way it seems to be. So along those lines, to me, it is interesting to think that perhaps an aesthetic space, really in the kind of Hegelian relationship of shapes in space, and that kind of aesthetic clash that arises from those aesthetic relationships, could provide for an understanding of justice that renounces the judicial, that leaves it aside. And I think that's something that victims that have been silenced often tend to do through singing, through organization of, you know, informal acting, through passing on histories in oral ways and viral ways, not necessarily by writing in official ways, but actually just dispersing stories. These are ways. These are aesthetic ways of finding a place, you know, reclaiming your citizenship that you have been stripped of. And certainly, I think Agamben is also somebody that has written about similar things with his bare life, and Judith Butler in the precariousness of the stripped body from society.
But at the same time, the victims would say the senior citizens and the people that came up after peace, they were looking for some kind of justice, right? I mean, there was this real problem that aesthetics and justice were faced with, where the state had failed these people, and they were looking to aesthetics to solve the problem, but it couldn't be solved, at least not in a tangible way. So,
well, but that's the question. It's whether it was actually my fault, my surrendering to the primacy of the normative judicial sphere by having said, okay, well, this failed. You know, like, I can't help you. Maybe it had already happened. Maybe there was something that was, maybe for 2 minutes there was a space that was built that I destroyed again because of my own insecurity. So I think it's maybe that there is room for that to happen. Just didn't quite.
Well, I think that was a great part of it. I mean, it was great to include that because it showed the vulnerability of sex. And, you know, on the one hand, it stirred the people in the square, and there was a kind of emotion that it brought about, and then it showed kind of the failing of the state.
Right.
But at the same time, there was a sense of, well, who is going to be our leader? Right, and where are we going to find this person? I mean, I thought that was really good to put that in there and show, on the one hand, the way that this can stimulate interest and emotion, and at the same time, you know, what are the limits of, mm-hmm. and what can be done after that, let's say.
Myers?
Various thoughts I want. One is, you didn't say that this piece of six parts was presented at the Guggenheim Museum very recently, and mm-hmm. I think that you deserve praise for that. It's not easy to get to the Guggenheim.
Thank you, man.
That was very important to reach an audience that was not, would probably not have come here today that we did, that we all did. Second, is interesting to note that you mentioned this law that the Congress has passed in Colombia almost 8 months or 9 months after President Santos took over, in which we all thought this is going to be just the same old thing and a continuation. It was actually signed into law Friday, last Friday at 5 p.m. in the presence of Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations in Bogota. It really signals that maybe things will be different. It's Colombia, President Santos said, it puts Colombia on the side of those that need the reparation. And this is the first time it has happened. And it's not a truth of reconciliation. It's really a reparation.
Reparation.
And maybe you want to do a sequel of this 5 years from now and see, because obviously last Friday was only 4 days ago, what has really happened. Because the expectations are very, very high because of that. The last comment is on memory, which you mentioned. The first speech that was there was 9th of April, 1948. And it's interesting to me that for many, many, many years, all you have to do is say the 9th of April. It's like 9/11. You don't know what it means. But it's interesting to note that how many years, 60-some years later, you would mention 9th of April. Most people would not react the same way as they did. So I wonder if 50 years from now, 9/11, people would react to who would do. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about memory in that sense of time and how things time transform. Is memory really alive in us and not in the history books only? And therefore, it really drops with time.
Do you want to talk about it? I don't know. The one thing that comes to mind, as you said, that is that as you say that is that memory is also constructed and selective, and so I don't know how much, for example, in the context of the United States, 9/11 will be allowed to be forgotten, because it signals something very very strong and very specific in terms of internal and foreign policy in this country.
Yeah, most people here don't know that 9/11 was obviously, as you said, the assassination of Jorge Diaz de Gaitán, but also
Salvador Allende, you mean? Salvador Allende, you mean?
I'm sorry. No, I know. I'm sorry.
Salvador Allende, you mean?
Okay. I was thinking about the rest of the but it also depicted the day and the night in which the whole center of Bogota and at least 5 other cities of Colombia were destroyed by mobs that reacted and then became in an uncontrolled situation, right? And it was terrible. So it was more than just the time, but it was also a reaction to that. So the effect of Colombia was similar to 9/11.
Right.
It was a total destruction of the center of Bogota and various cities. One would have thought forever we would remember this. And yet time has a way of forgetting or not being so clear. Kind of
Sina has a... we can hear you, Sina, sorry. Yeah, I'm glad you bring up this idea of authenticity, because that's one of the things that was completely ruptured with the lack of, you know, the going off script, in a sense. There was another hand back there. Well, I don't know that I would say that it was the piece failed. Actually, I think that rupture made the piece work. Now, I could not have intended that that was going to happen. So I think that the success of the piece actually is that political space that was that was enabled by this relationship. So I don't think that there is any notion of failure or success involved in this equation. Did I say it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. did I say it? Well?
Push it farther. If that accident hadn't happened, right? You are an artist. You're doing this because you believe in it. So I'm just asking you, what are the things that you want to have beyond the accident? How much is it intentional or not? Or maybe you were just looking for an accident and that was your practice.
Well, we were inserting people to speak to people on the street. So it was, of course, considered that in fact, it happened several times within the pieces. Just this one is the most concrete, that it created a certain kind of community around the actress. But of course, we were looking for that. I mean, we were intervening the everyday, if you will, hoping for something to occur like this. Now, we didn't quite know what was going to be that.
What was extraordinary there is that one of them made the bridge to you. He actually made the bridge between what you were doing and what they were doing. And probably your feeling of frustration was that when he did it, you didn't realize it and you didn't,
No, I think the feeling of frustration actually was this, the bridge between the fiction and the reality. Because to me, actually, the conflict started when I saw the face of the actress. Because at some point, she could not continue acting. She looked at me and she said, you know, she just told me, come now, right? Because I cannot continue playing a part when people are making demands. They think that I'm running for office. They think that I am campaigning. They think that I am proposing these things to them. And so how can I go on? I think that's the place that it's interesting to me, is that moment in which the art and the real totally clashed. And yeah.
And you know, like you were talking about the idea of a victim, like the whole work in about the idea of a victim, and then all of a sudden you had to face something that wasn't an idea.
Right. Yes.
I thought that piece was very interesting. Okay. Some things I'm not with the same ideas as everyone here, but there was a mention that politics is afraid to have like a failure or something, just because you have to win. Okay. If you don't win, you can get killed, or bad things can happen to you in politics. So, like an example would be Rosa Parks taking the bus. Okay. An art event would have been Rosa Parks and her friends going on the bus. Rosa Parks has a political, as a political act that had years of preparation there. She belonged to a group that had chosen her because she was like the perfect woman. She had the perfect background for it. And there was a political group behind her to continue that struggle. So, I thought it was interesting because the speeches were all very ennobling. Okay, we all felt really good listening to those speeches. We want to feel good, but then when those people showed their real conflicts, there was no way from simply listening here and feeling good and listening to that to make something happen. And that, to me, is the value of politics and the value of group activity organized in such a way that it's not to be dismissed. Martin Luther King made wonderful speeches about nonviolence, but he relied on the deep user defense so he could stand up there and not be shot. I mean, he could say, I don't believe in killing, but he had the deep user defense clear out the place for him before he spoke. So I think that's something we have to be very aware of. And also, the whole question of human rights, how do you define that? I mean, you seem to be assuming a certain culture of what is human rights. You know, maybe an Islamic culture has a different idea of human rights. Other cultures have a different idea of human rights. I mean, that's something that needs to be very carefully defined. I mean, I don't want to be on the side of people I don't agree with.
Janine?
On the subject of failure, I just have like a little anecdote to share, which is a speech that it was like a march that a former critical resistance activist, Kaino, she was leading a chant, when you want equal rights, when you want it now, so the chant that you often hear at protests. And at some point, she decided to depart from that chant and shouted, "What else do you want?" And everyone in the room on the street sort of went, "Oh." And that became a thing, and she started asking, like, "What else do you want? Doesn't matter if you can't say it, doesn't matter if you don't agree, just shout it and let something noisy happen." And nothing happened there. And I'm calling on this because I think that certain element of risk-taking of potential failure is intrinsic to politics even when done by activists. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, one thing I really appreciated about the aesthetic justice symposium is that a lot of the dichotomies that we think of, direct, indirect action, policy, non-help community organizing, reform, revolutionary, a lot of those binaries were sort of set aside for a moment, which is really nice, because I feel like sometimes in politics by activists, those binaries, I mean, they're negotiated, but they don't structure the entire
right.
And I sort of thought that in your talking about aesthetic justice and reconciliation, it also felt like a different composition of politics that was also outside of the conventions of politics. That
right.
You resorted to unconsciously in your video, but it felt like there was a composition.
Mm. Interesting. Thank you.
Should we end here?
Yeah, maybe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I did it.